The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, The Media Are Getting Easier to Push Around, by Paul Farhi. Until a few months ago, the tiny town of Atmore, Alabama, was perhaps best known for the glitzy casino and hotel complex on its northern border and its proximity to the prison where the state carries out executions. Then Steve and Billy decided to pick a fight with the hometown newspaper, the Atmore News. In October, the paper published a story based on an anonymous leak revealing that Billy, the county's district attorney, was conducting a grand jury investigation into possible financial fraud by the local school system. Shortly thereafter, Billy charged the paper's publisher, 73-year-old Sherry Digman, its only reporter, 69-year-old Don Fletcher, with violating a state secrecy law. Digman and Fletcher were cuffed by deputies they'd known for years and charged with felonies that could land them in the local prison for up to 3 years on each count. They maintained they'd merely reported news of importance. That a district attorney could use his official powers to criminalize an act of journalism in defiance of both the First Amendment and the public interest generated a brief ripple of national attention and criticism. But the Atmore arrests weren't all that unusual. Reporters and news organizations in hundreds of communities have faced interference, intimidation, and harassment from local officials in recent years. These episodes have occurred at a time of waning public support for the news media and amid the industry's ever-deteriorating financial condition. In other words, officials may be emboldened to bully the press because they believe they can get away with it. A few months before the Atmore arrests, for example, a similar scenario unfolded in Marion, Kansas, population 1,922. Earlier that week, the Marion County Record had revealed that a local restaurant owner who was seeking a liquor license had a series of disqualifying violations on her record, including a DUI. The business owner accused the record of breaching a confidential state database. The paper denied doing so. The otherwise mundane dispute exploded into a national story because of what it followed. The town's entire 5-member police force swept into the record's newsroom, collecting computers, cell phones, and files as evidence. A second group of officers descended on the home of the publisher, Eric Meyer, where Meyer's 98-year-old mother, Joan, put up a spirited defense in a confrontation caught on video. Less than a day later, she died, apparently of natural causes. The Record blamed her death on the stress of the police raid. Small weekly papers like those in Atmore and Marion are among the most economically marginal entities in the media. This makes them easy prey for opportunistic or aggressive elected officials. Although most publications are unlikely to face a police raid or arrests anytime soon, they are likely to go out of business. Nearly a third of America's newspapers have folded in the past 20 years, and most of these have been weekly papers in small communities, according to the local news initiative at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. Consider the plight of the McCurtain Gazette, a family-owned newspaper in rural Oklahoma. The paper reported in March that county commissioners had made a series of racist remarks during a meeting and had even discussed hiring a hitman to murder Gazette reporters who'd been digging into alleged misconduct. Comments captured by a reporter who left a voice-activated recorder on his seat after leaving the meeting. Instead of investigating the commissioners, however, the local sheriff's office launched an investigation of the Gazette, accusing the paper of altering the recording and violating state privacy law. The Atmore, Marion, and McCurtain episodes are sensational data points in a larger, darker, and more varied picture. A database maintained by the nonprofit Press Freedom Foundation documents roughly 1,000 incidents involving alleged official interference with the U.S. news media since 2017, including arrests of journalists, denial of access to official meetings and proceedings, and equipment searches and seizures. Many of these occurred in small towns and thus out of the national spotlight. Early last year, for example, Evan Lambert, a reporter for the News Nation cable network, was thrown to the ground by authorities in East Palestine, Ohio, who forcibly removed him from a press conference about the derailment of a train carrying toxic chemicals. The alarming rate of official actions against the news media can't be divorced from the hostile climate that surrounds reporting these days. Donald Trump has infamously referred to journalists as enemies of the people. His acolytes have gone even further, such as when Marjorie Taylor Greene called for journalists to be held accountable, even jailed, for what they did to Trump and our great country. The most alarming growth area for official interference with the press is so-called prior restraint, that is, court orders prohibiting the publication of information. The Supreme Court has consistently held that such orders are a kind of censorship that the First Amendment most clearly prohibits. And yet, 11 prior restraint orders were issued in 2023, the most since researchers began counting in 2017. Among the targets was Fletcher, the Atmore News reporter, whose bail term requires him not to break any more stories about the grand jury investigation that landed him in hot water. Some news media advocates, such as Seth Stern of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, have urged reporters to openly defy prior restraint rulings, deeming them blatantly unconstitutional. These rulings do tend to be struck down by higher courts or later withdrawn, but that can be a pyrrhic victory. Fighting the order can be costly and involve weeks or months of delay. By the time the legal battles are over, the value of whatever news has been suppressed may have declined to zero. An investigative report about, say, an official's misconduct in office would be pointless if a court kept the information from voters until after an election. The percentage of people expressing trust in news reporting last year fell to the lowest level since Gallup began asking the question in 1972. Self-described Republicans traditionally have had the highest mistrust of the press, but that sentiment has lately been increasing among Democrats and independents, too. Although profitable outfits such as the New York Times can afford to mount a defense against government overreach, the typical independent or small-town publication doesn't have pockets deep enough for a prolonged legal battle. Many news organizations that formerly would have fought government attempts to withhold records, close meetings, or otherwise hinder the press in their news gathering simply no longer commit resources to doing so, Jane Kirtley, a media and law professor at the University of Minnesota, told me. The true cost of media intimidation is measured not in public punishments handed out, but in stories never pursued. Smaller newsrooms or citizen journalists that are so afraid of the risk of a criminal prosecution, an aggressive search, or a lawsuit, regardless of how realistic of a threat those are, may alter what they'd be reporting on otherwise, Jennifer Granick, an attorney at the ACLU Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, told me. The silver lining is that so far, justice tends to prevail, though it can take a long time and cost a lot. The district attorney who approved and oversaw the confiscation of the Marion County records, computers, and other property wound up returning the material after a public outcry. The police chief who led the raids was suspended and eventually resigned. In McCurtain County, media attention surrounding the Gazette prompted Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt to call on four officials to resign. Two did so. Evan Lambert filed a civil rights lawsuit for the unlawful arrest in East Palestine. Last month, he obtained a $112,000 settlement. In Atmore, Sherry Digmore and Don Fletcher are still waiting their fate. As of this writing, more than 4 months after their arrest, no trial date has been set. Their attorneys, citing the First Amendment and case law upholding the right to publish legally obtained information, have asked a judge to dismiss the charges against them. If they prevail, it would be a validation of the constitutional right to a free press, a right that protects all Americans, not just journalists. But they still might think twice about exercising it. Next, from the planet section. Electric cars are still not good enough. The long, torturous wait for cheap EVs isn't ending in 2024. By Andrew Mosman. The Chevrolet Bolt was the little electric car that could. Never the fastest or fanciest EV, the Bolt and its sticker price of roughly $30,000 made it cheaper than a lot of gas cars, all the while delivering a respectable 259 miles of range. With its legion of fans, the Bolt outsold every non-Tesla EV in America last year. But if you want to buy a new one, you'd better hurry. Chevy's parent company, General Motors, stopped making the Bolt at the end of 2023. The demise of the Bolt was supposed to mark the end of the beginning. In place of the Bolt, GM's first mass-market EV, the company had planned to unleash a fleet of more advanced EVs earlier this year. It hasn't gone as anticipated. Software bugs, battery problems, and factory delays have plagued the cars. The battery-powered Equinox SUV has yet to go on sale, and its larger sibling, the Blazer, was released before GM suspended sales. You can buy the fully electric version of the Silverado pickup truck, but demand has been so lukewarm that GM has delayed production at a factory that, you guessed it, used to make the Bolt. Right now, America's transition to electric cars is stuck between stages. For electric cars to accelerate toward world dominance, car companies must sell millions of EVs to Americans with no attachment to the idea of battery-powered driving, not only to the early adopters, who had a few good options beyond Tesla and the Bolt. Now there are at least 50 models available, and nearly every large car maker has at least one true EV on the market. But few of them are affordable enough for many car buyers. And the next generation of EVs, the ones designed to entice people who have not yet gone electric, isn't coming soon enough. As a result, 2024 is shaping up to be a lost year for EVs, with little movement toward our supposed all-electric future. Even in a lost year, Americans are poised to keep buying EVs. Corey Cantor, a senior EV analyst at Bloomberg and EF, predicts 1.9 million electrified cars, which includes EVs and plug-in hybrids, to sell in 2024, an all-time high. But that's dwarfed by the fact that Americans bought more than 15 million total vehicles last year. Ford's EV sales jumped 80% last month over the previous February, but gained a grand total. The grand total amounted to just over 6,000 electric vehicles sold. Without the enormous sales they'd anticipated, car makers have walked back hasty electrification proclamations and grown cagey about the inevitability of EVs. In December, GM CEO Mary Barra hedged on its goal of selling only EVs by 2035, saying that although the company still plans to meet that target, we're going to be responsive to where the customer is at. In the face of disappointing EV truck enthusiasm, GM said it would build plug-in hybrid versions of its top trucks, something the company had dismissed just over a year ago as a half measure that would dilute its mission to electrify. In December, Ford halved the 2024 production goal for its electric F-150 truck. The unease isn't limited to the big car companies in Detroit. Mercedes pushed back its goal of 50% electrified sales, which includes hybrids, from 2025 to 2030. Maybe car makers should have seen this coming. The EV revolution has arrived at the end of its first era, which was propelled by early adopters who'd pay extra to save the planet or be seen driving the next big thing, says David Rabson, an economist at UC Davis who studies decarbonization. There are only so many of those people, he told me, and a lot of them already drive a Tesla. The next phase, when electric cars leap from early adoption to mass adoption, depends on the people Rabson calls the pragmatists, Americans who will buy whichever car they deem best and who are waiting for their worries about price, range, and charging to be allayed before they go electric. The current slate of EVs isn't winning them over. Tesla's Model Y, the top-selling EV by far, starts at $44,000. Popular models such as the Ford Mustang Mach-E, the Volkswagen ID.4, and the Hyundai Ioniq 5 are in the same ballpark, and many early entrants into the EV race cost much more. Meanwhile, the gas-powered Honda CR-V that rules the suburbs starts at $29,500. A Toyota Prius starts for even less. Without the Chevy Bolt, a bargain EV shopper has few options beyond the uncertain market for used electric cars. They can be had for cheap because older EVs are depreciating fast. But the driving range declines as they age for the same reason your smartphone battery fades. That is not the only reason EVs are not taking off, of course. Public chargers are sorely lacking and prone to malfunctions, and car dealers can lack necessary info about EVs and what tax credits they qualify for. But price matters most of all, and there are just far too few cheap EVs. Following the Bolt's surprisingly good sales, GM reversed course and promised to revive its best-selling EV with a better version. But it won't arrive until next year. Lots of other cheap electric cars aren't ready either. Tesla is reportedly working on a new entry-level EV that will start at just $25,000, which the company appeared to confirm in a recent earnings call. But the long-awaited vehicle won't debut until next June at the earliest, and probably later given Tesla's tendency to miss its own deadlines. In that same announcement, Elon Musk warned that Tesla would be between two major growth waves in 2024, as the top EV brand would not have a new EV for sale. Ford has been developing an affordable electric for the masses in secret, but it won't likely come this year either. Yesterday, Rivian revealed its more affordable electric SUVs, but those won't hit the street for another 2 years at least. The place cranking out very cheap EVs is China, which has Europe and the U.S. in a furor over how to stop them from upending the market. In 2024, then, shoppers considering an EV might do best to wait out the year into the industry's lost year. Even if sales numbers tick up slightly, and February did see a year-over-year increase, that slow, steady growth won't put EVs on pace to go mainstream anytime soon. I think a lot of these people are on hold, Lauren McDonald, the CEO of the consulting firm EV Adoption, told me. They're going to wait a few years for the perfect model. Faced with a complicated car market in flux, buyers will go with what they know. That means just staying with the regular gas-powered Ford Explorer. Considering that a car stays on the road for a decade or more, that adds up to a lot of carbon dioxide we would otherwise avoid. Then there is the election, the outcome of which may compound this lost year. Donald Trump has made electric car antagonism part of his campaign, and his victory would sap federal support for electrification, just as EVs are maybe ready to turn a corner in 2025. During an election year, I think there's a natural tendency to hedge, just because we don't know how things are going to shake out, Cantor told me. Car companies that charged ahead with electric models under Joe Biden might rethink their ambitions in the case of a Trump win, Cantor said. Politics could stymie the advance of EVs in other ways. Rabson's third batch of American buyers after the enthusiasts and pragmatists is the holdouts, people who might reject electric cars outright. That includes millions of potential buyers of electrified Ford and Chevy trucks who, for reasons political and mechanical, have shown little interest in battery-powered pickups. Pickup buyers do not want electric trucks, McDonald said. Their reluctance casts doubts on the goal of total electrification put forth by politicians and car execs. The car industry's malaise is a response to a mirage. A country without adequate charging infrastructure and with lots of drivers who resent the idea of electric cars was never going to meet soaring declarations and 2030 deadlines that promised America would electrify in a hurry. But EVs can overcome a lost year. No matter what, the cars will get cheaper, and sooner rather than later. So many cars and billions of dollars have gone into electrifying the car industry that it's now impossible to stop. Small SUVs in the $35,000 range, such as the Chevy Equinox and the Volvo EX30, are coming later this year, which could generate momentum for 2025. Once automakers fill the holes in the EV market with practical vehicles that cost about as much as gas cars, tax credits or no tax credits, the car shopping decision will come down to whether Americans believe that EVs are truly better cars, period. More pragmatists will start to say yes. Then their neighbors will decide it's time to keep up. And then when electric cars are just cars, EV haters might still decide that a $25,000 Tesla is worth it. Our third article for this episode, A Subtle Shift is Shaking Up Sibling Relationships, by Michael Waters. Growing up with a sibling who is much younger than you can be a profoundly humbling experience. In casual conversation, you might suddenly find yourself fumbling to parse Gen Z terminology, or pretending to know the identities of some alleged celebrities they keep name-dropping. You don't even duke it out in the same way. Whereas siblings close in age might skirmish over whose turn it is to pick the night's TV show, these debates take on a different contour when one is in middle school and the other is in college. Siblings with a several-year age gap were once considered exceptional, but they are quietly becoming more common. From 1967 to 2017, the average time between sibling births increased by about 3/4 of a year, according to data from a study published in 2020. Siblings are now, on average, 4.2 years apart. The tit-for-tat arguments over, say, who gets the shower first, that have been associated with sibling relationship for decades, are not going away completely. Yet these larger age gaps have opened the door for a new kind of dynamic, one premised more on mentorship than on a battle for limited attention or resources. Squabbles for parental attention are giving way, at least in some families, to a sense that there is enough to go around for everyone. This norm of spaced-out siblings seems to be a byproduct of the changing American family. The reasons are difficult to parse, but we know that partner switching explains some of it. Christine Schwartz, a sociology professor at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, who co-authored the 2020 study on the phenomena, told me. But the rise of multi-partner fertility is not the only driver of increased time between children. Another is the availability of contraceptives since the 1960s, which has helped women to control the timing of their children. Parents might also be waiting longer between kids because it's so expensive to have one in the United States. These birth spacing decisions are starting to shake up one of the most important relationships of our lives. Studies measuring the effects of a large age gap attribute changes in test scores and personality, among other things, to the time between siblings' birth. If there is a common thread tying them together, it is resources. The further apart in age siblings are, the more attention and, potentially, financial investment each of them may receive from their parents. Those extra resources can translate into early in life academic success. A 2012 study found that the test scores improved for the older sibling the larger the gap until the next child. The time the older child spends on their own is key. Casey Buckles, a professor at the University of Notre Dame, who co-authored the study, told me, "In the most extreme cases, siblings with many years between them are likely seeing the strongest effects, as well as propelling the average population level increase in age gaps." Brian Powell, a sociologist at Indiana University at Bloomington, who researches siblings, told me, "A big sibling age gap has implications beyond academics. Children with many years between them are less likely to have intense rivalries and more likely to listen to each other. A classic study from 1973 found that younger siblings are more likely to take the advice of a sibling who is 4 years older than the one who is just 2 years older. A more recent research has even tied the larger age gap to an increased ability to diffuse conflict." That doesn't mean the growing divergence in sibling births is all positive. Kids from different parents might have to contend with other issues: joint custody, the challenges of divorce, independent of age differences. Also, sibling arguments can teach important lessons about cooperation and splitting up resources. A recent paper found that children who had a sibling more than 3 years older or younger were less likely to share a cupcake with a close friend than children who had one closer in age. Having access to resources can play in different ways, Powell said. You can have greater self-esteem, but it also could mean that you don't learn how to share with others. For Powell, it seems pretty clear that this new age-based reality is benefiting older siblings, at least for those with the largest gaps between them and their younger siblings. The average sibling age gap probably won't go on forever. The limited biological window in which people can have kids puts a cap on how far apart in age a set of children can be. Plus, more spacing between births means more time at home raising young kids and potentially greater interruptions to the career of one or both parents. For parents without a high school diploma, the average sibling age gap has widened so dramatically that these parents are actually spending more years of their life raising young kids than they would have in 1967. This is the irony of sibling age gaps. More time between births might benefit kids, but it doesn't necessarily translate into lighter load for parents. The struggle for resources remains, even if it ends up stretched across a longer period. Plus, any time saving that could come from combining parenting duties, such as dropping off both kids at soccer practice at the same time, is lost when those kids are very different in very different life stages. Older children may be able to lend a helping hand, but that responsibility can be its own burden. Now that potential parents have more control over when they want to start a family, their decisions about birth spacing remains a quandary of resource allocation. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5100.